Right, so we're talking about proposals. And every salesman knows you can't sell a product without giving the client something in writing. Usually even the first step, they say, okay, sounds vaguely interesting, but send me something in writing. The problem is, for most salespeople, and I'd say probably a fair few small business owners as well, is that they spend most of their time writing proposals which never generate a sale. So how do you put the product or service in front of the client, making it attractive, without spending all of that time writing proposals that don't go anywhere?
Well, first of all, very often when a client says, very interesting, send me a proposal, he's saying that because he's not interested at all and he doesn't want to listen to you, okay? So one of the things you have to avoid is writing a proposal before you actually have the basics agreed. We do a lot of work with companies of all sorts of different sizes, looking at their proposal or quotation process, if you prefer. And one of the first things we look at in order to gauge the effectiveness of their sales process is what percentage of their proposals they win or they lose. Very recently, within the last year, we did a project for a company here in Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and first of all, they didn't know how many proposals they won or lost.
Right.
Which is, and secondly, when we did the analysis, it was 3%.
They won 3%?
They won 3%.
So out of every 100, not 10, out of every 100 that they sent, only 3 resulted.
So what does that tell you?
Well, they spent an awful lot of time writing
proposals. It tells you that they have substituted the writing of quotations for a real sales process, because it's actually easier to write quotations if you use a template than it is to actually go out, find a client, tease his needs out of him or her, and come to some kind of agreement on what's actually needed and how it should be priced. That's actually hard work. And by the way, if you do that properly and you're honest about the level of engagement that you are getting, you will write far fewer proposals, but you will win a much higher percentage. So when we're trying to improve a client's proposal process, the first thing we do is look at how many they're winning, and we say, as a rule of thumb, you should win at least 50%. Why? Because you should never write a proposal until you have qualified the opportunity to the point where it is at least 50% likely to be won.
Right. Yeah. And in the lead up to that, what, you just send them a one-page email to say, these are the list of our services, well, here's our marketing collateral?
Well, if as a business you're not comfortable with that process, then it's like anything else. Rather than winging it, you need to actually sit down and actually figure out what those steps are. What questions do you ask? The way that we would define it is, you used the word stakeholder earlier, first of all, need to define what...
I didn't, but
off
never
camera. You need to define what the buying process is. So very often you're not dealing with one person. So who are the stakeholders who can influence the decision to make that purchase? And typically stakeholders are either just influencers or they may be deciders. And you have to know who the deciders are. In other words, people that have the power of yes or no. And you need to know that individually, they are at least neutral on the subject of your proposal, ideally positive. And what you never do, you never put in a written proposal until those key stakeholders are at least neutral, ideally positive, yeah? Because you'll lose. It's a certainty. So who are they? So what's the buying process? That's one of the key questions you have to ask. Secondly, what are the needs? Thirdly, what's the competitive situation, right? Mm-hmm. Who else is bidding, yeah? And fourthly, is there a budget? I mean, a rather obvious question, but in my early days as a salesman, I was always so delighted that anybody would talk to me that I would quite often walk away thinking, oh, a proposal. And it would turn out, well, look, sometimes the ones that like me would say, well, that's pretty good. We really like to do this, but actually, you know, we don't really have any money, which they could have told me right at the beginning. So now I look the guy in the eye within the first 5 minutes of the first meeting and say, just to help me, you know, how does your decision-making and budgeding process work? Who makes decisions on this particular service and how would that be authorized? And if it turns out that they never hire or they never take that particular service or they don't have any money, then I don't have to spend any more time in that room.
So you just pay for coffee and leave?
So I say, okay, that's fine. Well, no, I would always, you know, the best thing next to a sale, as you know, is a qualified relationship. In other words, somebody that says, were I to need that and were I to be in a position to spend that money, you would definitely be, you, Mr. Lowdy, would be the man that I would call, yeah? That's the second best thing, and that's what you're looking for from a sales meeting. Mm. And what you learn over time as you get a bit longer in the tooth is that that is actually a very common outcome, and that is a very good outcome to a meeting.
Right.
And what you then do is you keep revisiting that individual, and you keep re-qualifying that, giving the plate another spin, you know?
Yes. So is it still up in the air?
And sooner or later, it will happen. And I've seen this. I've done this long enough now to see this happen, sometimes after as long as 2 or 3 years. Sometimes the guy goes to a new job. He gets hired. And he's in a totally different situation, and the problem's on his desk, and he thinks, oh, I know. I spoke to Simon about that, you know, and he seemed to have some good ideas, you know.
Right. Next question then, of course, has to be, let's assume that your initial communication was face-to-face, you've understood the client's needs, maybe you've passed them some sales collateral, which, you know, you've got 100 copies of, so you haven't spent a lot of time on. It's come to the proposal stage. There are some proposals I've seen which run into dozens and dozens of pages. And even if they have an executive summary at the beginning, I'm exhausted just looking at the front cover.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you don't want to just hand over a 2 or 3 page proposal, which is so vague that it could mean anything. So how do you strike that balance?
That's a very good question. To be honest, I usually find it's my clients that make the proposals longer. I mean, you may want to do that in stages. I mean, ideally, I'd want to get, depending on how big a proposal we're talking about, I'd want to get the stakeholders together and talk them through an approach and get them to tick that. Because to me, as I think I said at the beginning, it's axiomatic, dare I use that word again, to an effective proposal process, you don't put pen to paper until the essentials of what you're writing have already been agreed. So the timing, the cost, and the main deliverables of whatever it is you're doing, whether it's a service or the functionality of the goods or whatever it is. To my mind, that should, in essence, have been agreed. And the proposal is in the form of a confirmation, in essence, of what has already gone before. It is most emphatically not the first time that you're putting out a set of ideas because, you know, first of all, you're highly unlikely to win. Secondly, there's a good chance he won't even read it if that's the level of engagement.
That's just it, particularly if it's too long. If it's ring-bound with a plastic cover on the top.
I don't think that makes any difference. And I think you need to make sure you get the guy's attention, and that's done not by sending them a document, typically. And I find that I get fobbed off a lot, or people attempt to fob me off a lot with, you know, okay, send me a proposal. And I don't. That is premature proposing.
But they still want to know some ideas. Come on, Simon, what are you going to do for me? That's a reasonable question to ask.
Well, you know, I mean, I think what you do is you lay out there what you're going to do. I mean, and, you know, you mentioned sales collateral. I mean, I'm very cautious about sales collateral. What's the best form of sales collateral is, yeah, I've worked with Mark, and he did an absolute bang-up job. So typically, early on in the process, they'll say, yeah, well, I actually haven't heard of who are you, you know, and have you ever worked with anyone? And you know, so how do you respond? He said, well, actually, yes, I've worked with quite a lot of clients. And the interesting thing is that most of my business is repeat business because the experience that they have is generally positive, and they're kind enough to say very positive things about the work we do. And then they say, well, that's interesting. And you say, well, you know, if we get to, what I don't like to do is I don't like to involve my clients in selling for me, you know, so I don't involve them in a discussion like this unless it's clear that there's some kind of basis of agreement. So what I'd like to do is continue this discussion with you, and if it appears, you know, that we can help you, and if we can get broad agreement on what those terms are, you know, timing and cost and so on and so forth, then, you know, I can give you a number of options in terms of clients that you can speak to in your line of business who would be prepared to speak off the record, probably, about, you know, the kind of quality of work that we've been able to do in the past.
A testimonial that's not written but spoken.
Well, yeah, because, you know, that in itself is interesting because clients quite often like to speak to their peer group anyway. So if you pick the right companies to refer to, very often that will become an interesting thing in itself, which will give them a reason to pursue the process because they're quite interested in having that conversation, right? Secondly, it qualifies you, and thirdly, it avoids you having to get involved in long qualification discussions before you've actually talked about the opportunity. So get the opportunity to a point where it's ready to go. Then have the qualified client, who, by the way, you've primed, because there will be specific aspects of what you do that you'll want him to emphasize. You won't want him to rabbit on for 40 minutes about, you know, I go down the pub with Mark every night and he's really great, and oh, that rugby tour, he went on to New Zealand, boy, that was wonderful, you know.
That would never happen anyway.
you want him to come specifically, whatever it is, if it's sales productivity, if it's you know, media coaching, if it's had a babe on camera, he was really good at that. So you coach him that he qualifies those particular issues. And then and only then do you put pen to paper. And in terms of keeping the proposal short, the way to structure a proposal is to have a very simple terms of reference for the actual work, and then to have all the other stuff behind it
in appendices.
And you then write in the covering email, you say, to understand, if you're short of time, just go to this section, and there, in two pages, we will describe what it is we propose to do. If you're comfortable with this, all the other terms are set out below, but for reference, here's what we're suggesting in terms of cost, here's what the next steps are. That way, he looks at the email, goes to page three, looks at it, says, okay, I'm okay with that, yeah. Mm.
Okay, so finally, let's say whether your proposal gets accepted or not, how much of that proposal is safe to reuse next time you speak to a completely different client, but you want to save yourself some time, you copy and paste?
Well, the more the better, right? Because that way you save time.
Just make sure that you change the company's name.
Because
I'm sure you've seen that happen before too, right?
Well, yes. I mean, I'd shoot anybody if they did that, if they were working for me and they did that. I mean, it's a balance, isn't it? I mean, as a company, you build intellectual property and you build experience, and part of your ability to generate profit comes from the fact that you can leverage that. I mean, I sort of have a rule of thumb for every document that I issue, whether it's a PowerPoint or a Word document, which is that I like to aim to add at least one significant new insight or change to the form every time that I use it, so that from a professional pride perspective, I can say, well, yeah, okay, so it's very much, you know, the same thing, because it was a good thing, but actually we made a change to that, and that's an innovative thing. And what happens then is, if you go back and you look over 2 years, you'll see that the material is evolving in a pretty solid way. So what, in a year's time, it may look pretty significantly different from what you've got now. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And the other thing is, of course, as you know very well, some large companies require you to submit proposals in a particular format. I mean, that's always a bit of a challenge, because that tends to be driven by legal requirements and is not always a very commercially friendly format. Mm. So sometimes you have to think your way around that.
Oh, goodness. How are we ever going to cope with that?
Yeah.
I know how. You can send me a proposal and tell me about it.
Yeah. So to me, I mean, it does happen. I mean, you know, competitive bids, I don't know if you ever do those. I mean, that's quite difficult. But the bottom line is, if you haven't qualified people, and if you're not reasonably confident that you're going to get it, don't get it wrong. I still get wrong-footed all the time. My time gets wasted. Mm. Sometimes I detect two-thirds of the way through the process that my time is in fact being wasted.
Right.
And then I take a decision on whether or not I'm going to go ahead with it.
Right. So your leads have to be qualified, or decide that they are unqualified, otherwise you're disqualified.
Well, yes, let me qualify that. Because there are some cases where a company, because of its size or potential importance to you as a source of work, where you may decide to continue the pursuit, even though you suspect that in that particular instance you will not win. You may want to do that because you're establishing good faith. You may want to do that because it's giving you access, repeated access, to certain stakeholders. And you may make that a condition of submitting the proposal, because there are certain dynamics that you can play in your favor. Some companies can't actually select a service provider unless they get 3 written proposals. And in many cases, if not most, they'll actually know who they want to work with before they even issue the tender. I mean, that's the reality.
Mm.
Yeah. Because the reality is that procurement departments set these parameters, but individuals working in companies want to work with service providers that they're comfortable with and like. You can leverage that process if you detect you're being played, which is that you can agree to participate in it by implicitly agreeing that you will be given access to certain stakeholders and to a certain information. And what it does is it enables you to build your credibility, because you're allowed to make a presentation, you're allowed to talk to people, so that at some future point you can build on that and have another go. So when I say you always want to win, there are, as I say, certain commercial situations in which you might want to make a decision that you're going to submit a proposal anyway.
Mm.
But you need to be in control. You need to be clear that there is a sound commercial rationale for doing that.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for the consultancy, Simon. Presumably you're going to send me the invoice now.
For you, Mark, no.